I'm Daniel Chacon. Welcome to another edition of Words on a Wire. Today, I'm going to talk to poet Cynthia Cruz about her latest book, How the End Begins. It is a fantastic and often dark, psychologically speaking, a very dark book, but it's also very beautiful. And if anyone can take darkness and make it beautiful, it's Cynthia Cruz. You got to check this book out. She is the author of Wunderkammer, The Glimmering Room, and Ruin, all of them books of poems. She has been published in The New Yorker, The Kenyon Review, The Paris Review, The Boston Review, as well as many other journals that have rejected everything I have sent them. This book, How the End Begins, is her latest book. Cynthia Cruz, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Thank you for inviting me.
And you're in New York City right now. Is it cold?
You know, it's not actually. I think it's about 57 degrees.
Oh, wow.
It's pretty remarkable. Yeah, it's nice.
It's warmer than it is here in the desert.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Before we start talking about your latest book of poems, How the End Begins, maybe we can get a little bit of background on you, where you're from, how you came into poetry.
It's a long story, but...
we got time.
I'll try to make it very short. My father is Mexican-American, and he grew up in Wyoming, very strange place to grow up. He grew up on a farm. He worked on the field and didn't finish grammar school, but he escaped. Literally, that's what he said. He escaped and joined the Air Force. So he escaped by joining the Air Force because that's how he could get a job.
Right.
And that's how he met my mom in Germany at someplace, a bar, I guess. And that's how I came to be. And I was born on an Air Force base, so I was born in Wiesbaden, Germany, but it's an American Air Force base. So that's actually a great metaphor because I was just thinking actually before you called that I am, my mom is German, my dad is Mexican-American, but I'm, in a weird way, I'm neither Mexican nor German, you know, because I'm a mix, or because, you know, the whole thing. And anyway, but neither of my parents went to high school. Oh, sorry, that's not true. I went to college. My dad didn't go to high school. So when I finished high school, and I barely finished high school. I had a hard time in high school. Really, no.
Were you a bad student?
I went back and forth between being a straight A student and then I just stopped going to class.
Right. Yeah, more you were a bad student, more out of rebellion than out of inability.
Exactly. So, but when I did finish high school, that was a big deal, and my parents got a cake for me and pizza, and and my friends, you know, were off going to Berkeley and things like that, and I'm trying to skip over all this stuff. Anyway, but so actually college was not an option. It wasn't that it was ever told to me that it wasn't an option. It just wasn't in the periphery at all, if that makes sense. And that's how a lot of my experiences have been. It's not that I decided not to do things and do things later in life. They were not part of my world. I mean, I grew up in a working class, working poor family, so many of these things just weren't there. So, but I did eventually go to a community college and then got the idea that I would go to a real college. Oh, I didn't mean to say real college. a four-year college, and that's what I did. And it wasn't until my final year at Mills College, where I finally graduated, that I took a poetry workshop. And now that I'm talking, I'm realizing I have a lot of these experiences where it was wonderful, but it was also not. But it was wonderful enough that I thought this might be the thing. And the last thing I'll sort of say about that is when I did go to the community college, I got a $300 scholarship. And I remember, and it's from, forgot the acronym, but it was for Latino students. And there was an event, and I got to speak, and I don't remember all of it, but I remember I was so honored, you know, and I was so grateful that I was the first person in my family ever to go to college, and I said that I would move forward, and my job was to speak on behalf of the people who couldn't speak, and I was thinking of the other, you know, just the people, and so many of the people I've met in my life, you know, who have died or exist in poverty or all that stuff, that was my quote-unquote job, and that is one thing that is carried through up until now. And I took a year off from college. Basically, everyone I knew said, you know, don't get an MFA. That's the dumbest. I mean, it's a dumb thing, right? Coming from a family, you know, where we struggled, it just doesn't make any sense to take out whatever it is, $100,000 to become a poet. But then I did.
That's interesting. As I'm listening to your story in a nutshell, I'm thinking of when I was in high school. I was, I suppose I was, you know, thought of myself as a rebel, and I flunked out of a lot of classes and used to have a lot of teachers who would say to me, Daniel, you're so smart. Why are you not doing well? I imagine you got that speech from a lot of your teachers, that they saw something in you, and because you're brilliant, obviously, with your poetry and what I've read, what you've written. So I imagine you got that speech a lot.
No, and I'm so glad you brought that up, because that pause that occurred when I was telling I was giving my speech, telling the story, there was a moment there where I hesitated and then I started back up. That was me staying in this, I guess it's resentment, actually, because, in fact, no teacher ever told me that. And
really?
In fact, my brother, my sister, and I, apparently, I found out, you know, years later by talking to other people, humans, that that you meet with a college counselor on your high school campus. Everybody does that, and they tell you what you might want to do. And we never did. All three of us were never invited for that conversation. And nobody ever spoke to me about, I was in AP German. I was in Shakespeare and got an A, but nobody ever said anything like that to us. So I chalk that up. I figure that means it's class. Classism and racism.
Yeah,
I'm
absolutely.
Not entirely sure, but that did not help. You know, that kind of, and that's actually been a continuing thread through college,
wow.
where people actually ended up telling me, when I was at Mills, actually, I got the idea I might want to get a PhD. It was this crazy idea. And I went to talk to, I believe it was the chair, it was a white man, and he said, you know, he said something like, yeah, you're not fit for this. You couldn't do it. And that was, you know, that's all I needed to know. And now I'm in a PhD program, but it's, you know, many, many years later.
Right.
So that's something I think about a lot when I'm working with, you know, students or talking to people, is that not only are many of us not encouraged, many of us are actually discouraged.
Yeah, that's amazing. I mean, with kind of, you know, you getting these good grades in the classes that were related to language. And I imagine that, you know, internalizing this lack of support and this rebellion, that it maybe pushed on the poet part of you that needed to express something about it, needed to get something out, and that, as well as the fact that you probably grew up around three languages. I imagine, obviously, your mother was fluent in German and probably yelled it out in the house and, you know, in emotional moments, maybe always. And your dad, even if he wasn't completely bilingual, I'm sure he used a lot of Spanish language around the house. Mm-hmm. And all these, this exposure to language, and it must have maybe cause you to think about words in a different way than maybe a normal kid? Not normal kid.
No, that's right. And that's actually something I thought of a lot, and I wrote a couple essays on language because my dad was actually never home because he worked all the time, but his first language was Spanish, and so he still is fluent in Spanish. But my mom, she came over here when she was 17. Really super young, right? So she was very young. By the time I was in kindergarten, she wasn't 17 anymore, but she was still very young, and she was quite isolated. So I don't remember, but I'm assuming, I'm quite certain that there was German in the house only, and then the English would have been in that time. The English my mom learned was English, you know, and now Germans can choose between English or American English, right? So that means that we were speaking very strangely, but right, so it was this weird, I think it was this strange thing, and I don't have tapes of myself or anything, so I don't know, but I do know that the first K through second grade, or at least, I didn't speak in school at all, and I actually had to go to speech therapist. So did my sister, actually, and so I tried to figure that out, and I think part of it is the language thing and growing up with these other languages. And then, and what happens too when you say something, you know, and then somebody reflects back the strangeness that they're encountering and what that does. So I think, and then the other thing now is that I think that I was a poet even before, I don't mean to make a rhyme, but I was a poet before I knew it.
You were a poet before you were a poet.
Exactly. Yes, exactly.
That makes a lot of sense, you know, and I'm thinking of, there's this wonderful passage in Joyce's Ulysses where the character, I think it's Stephen, is listening to the cleaning woman and she's speaking Gaelic. And he grew up around Gaelic, but he didn't understand it. And so it just became musical to him. It became music. And I'm wondering if being around so many languages maybe caused music inside of you that perhaps was more melodic than it was in terms of sense. And maybe if that's one of the reasons why your language is so musical.
Yeah, but I just have to say, I love that it was through the cleaning lady. It makes me think of Clarice Lispector and how the cleaning lady is always the prophet or the music maker or whatever. That's so beautiful. But yeah, no, completely. And actually, when I was in the MFA program, one of the craft classes, we had to learn how to do iambic pentameter.
Uh-huh.
And apparently, I watched my classmates and I got it right away. You know, it's mathematical and they got it and I could not get it. And I took that class actually twice and I never got it. But then I realized later my poems are very musical, and I think you're right that it's actually this internal music. It's not this external craft that I'm putting onto the poem, although I work with it. I think that that's true.
Yeah, you know, because as I'm going through your book, you have, like, there's this one line image you have. It's on Fatigue Empire, and I'm going to read it. It's the warden of the underworld in her plastic pink wheelchair serving silver trays of and death and black gelatinous. I mean, it's so beautiful, and it takes me into this archetypal or imagistic landscape, but nonetheless, it's not a very concrete landscape, and your poetry seems to do that a lot. It brings you into this alternate universe that isn't necessarily real or is real in a different sort of sense. And I'm thinking that you probably have an incredibly strong inner life, for lack of a better explanation of what I'm trying to say.
Right.
That you have quite an inner life that you translate, and your translation of what's going on inside comes out as music and images, and they do make sense, but they make poetic sense, I guess you could say.
Right. And I think that the thing that I was, that I've been thinking about, I did a master's thesis a year ago, 2015, and it was on silence in the work of four authors, female artists and writers. And the thing I was thinking about was silence and how the experience of being marginalized, you know, is being silenced, but that then they use the silence in their work. But also I was thinking of how they created their own language, right? And I was thinking of Clarice Lispector, of course, but also Margaret Duras. So I think that's exactly it. If it's not going to be like anyone else's, if we actually are writing from our own experience precisely, right? And funny, I've been teaching workshops for many years now, and I've gotten to the point where I almost feel like the best way to do that is to simply read each student's poem. I mean, maybe the way that you just read mine and say what's there and what we notice, and then that's it. Because really, the best teaching I have done is where I can reflect that student's work, you know, the writing that's actually there on the page. I mean, right? That's once you understand craft and things like that. But still, if I tell somebody, well, you should start writing like X, Y, and Z, right, that's completely off the mark. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, there's this wonderful review of your work in the New York Times, and they're comparing you to, I think, was it C.K. Williams?
Right.
Yeah. And you're totally different poets. And of course, the article acknowledged that. But, you know, it makes me think to enter into a Cynthia Cruz poem is a different experience to enter into, say, a Philip Levine poem. I mean, you do enter into it. And I think once you have us, you know, it's kind of, at least in this book, I haven't read your other ones yet, but I'm going to because I'm so enthralled with this one. But it seems like when we enter into your poems, we're entering into a landscape that is almost like a nightmarish fairy tale.
Right.
What do you imagine when you write a poem? How do you imagine a reader is going to access the experience? Do you think it's going to be through emotion? Is it through landscape? Is it through image? Is it through music?
You know, I guess I don't think of that, but the thing that happens to me all the time, and I've just been thinking about a lot, is I'm constantly surprised and shocked. That's kind of where the Twitter things come from, is I just can't believe something, and then I'll tweet it. I just think, I can't believe this. This is crazy. And so I think when I write, I'm not thinking about what anyone's going to think, and that's And now I realize that's very remarkable, and I'm very grateful for that because it allows me to just go in and do this thing. But I kind of assume that everyone's going to get it,
right?
You know, and I think that's a funny thing. And, you know, I'm always surprised because of my own experience, which is, you know, it's marginalized in a different way, right? So now I'm in a PhD program, and I'm a guest at Sarah Lawrence, and I'm a poet, but I also, I'm trying to think of the word, it's a precarious existence. I mean, my health care is contingent on being a student, and that health care is questionable. I go to clinics, for example, and I support my husband who's disabled, so we live off of the fellowship money. I mean, so even though in a way, you know, I'm in a sort of like middle class existence, I'm actually not. And so I see things, you know, from my own experience. And then if I do see things, I am in clinics. I do see the homeless person, and I do, you know, for example, I know we're at war with all these countries, and we have been, whereas many people don't seem to notice that. And so that's the world I'm writing about. I just, of course, this is the world, you know, the fact that most people don't have hot water. That's true. But I put it in a book, and you're right, it is very, people say, you know, it's frightening or it's nightmarish. But then I would say that is, that's the world we live in.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right? I mean, so that's the thing. But it's funny because, and I think now maybe the book, I haven't seen anybody talk about it now, but I think that the conversations are starting to shift and people are starting to get, you know, afraid.
Right.
But that's the other thing, too, is that many people have been living like this the whole time anyway, you know.
Right. You know, you have a line in one of your poems. It's called Midnight Office. And the last two stanzas, if you say I am a mystic, then fine, I'm a mystic. The trees are not trees anyway. I love that line because, you know, it's like, oh, yeah, okay, sure, fine, I'm a mystic. And then the line goes on to talk about trees not being trees, which is certainly the way a mystic would see. And I'm wondering how much of when you're writing a poem, when you're really into maybe the first draft of the poem, you're just really inside this mystical, for lack of a better word, landscape, how much you resist, or do you need to resist being rooted? Allow it to go into, you know, the world of non-representation? I don't know if that question makes sense to you.
No, it's a good question. I think that when I first started, no, that's not true. I think when I was in the MFA program, my writing was maybe not more like the way it is. Maybe it was just a nightmare. I think without the ground, I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, because the world, I think, it depends on the book. Some of my books have more world in it. The Glimmering Room has lots of references to stuff, and Zundercomer as well, to the actual objects in the world. I think this does less, maybe that's what you mean, though, but I think they're more grounded and rooted than they were.
Well, maybe I don't know what I mean. I guess but what I'm thinking is how when we enter into a poem, or when we create a poem, that we're often going into landscapes that are not literal, that we spend a lot of time in these landscapes that are just as real, but where trees aren't trees, where trees are possibilities, or trees, you know, even if you want to reduce it to a, you know, some sort of Swedenborgian type of interpretation of trees, trees represent something in a different world. And I'm thinking that your poetry is mystical, and maybe this is why that, I don't know, that where that line comes from, that people are entering into mystical landscapes when they enter into your poems. And you are able to enter into them. I'm not pushed out at all. And I love that about your poetry. It takes me into, like, that passage that I read about the pink wheelchair. I have no idea where that is, but I'm able to enter into it where things are not things. That doesn't make sense either, does it?
No, it does. But as you're asking me the question, I'm trying to figure out, right, I see that how that happens, but I'm trying to figure out where I am when I'm doing them. But I don't know if that's the question.
Yeah, you know, I'm sorry. I don't know what the question is. And but see, that's where your poetry takes me. It takes me to these questions that maybe I don't even know how to articulate the question. But let's get something, maybe we move on to a more concrete question. Clearly, you have a poetic and probably even an emotional relationship with a German poet, and I think I might be pronouncing her wrong, Ingeborg Bachmann?
Yeah, yeah, yes.
Ingeborg Bachmann. I mean, you make a lot of references to her, and you have a quote by her. And I'm wondering, when you write in Fatigue Empire, the poem is its own language. If somehow that line and that poem is in communication with this German poet.
Right. It isn't directly, but the thing about Ingeborg Bachmann is that, so I'll give a little... Do you know about her?
No, I was only referenced to her through your book, and I looked her up a little bit and read one of her poems. But
so I'll try to do like a four-sentence thing, which is fine. So she was Austrian, and her first memory she recounts is of the Nazis entering her town or village. Mm-hmm. And that informs everything. So she got a PhD and studied Wittgenstein, I believe that's true. Right, so this whole idea of that things that the truth cannot be spoken or what cannot be spoken, that was his thing, and that was her main obsession. And that informed her writing, and she was a young poet. She won all the great prizes, and she was very close also with Paul Celan. And at a certain point, she quit writing poetry because she felt like the language itself, the thing that she realized was even after World War II ended, there was still fascism in society. And it was still part of the language. The language had already been taken, you know what I mean.
Right,
anyway,
right.
So she was just, with poetry, she felt like she was just reworking this stuff. So she quit that and started writing fiction. And her final project is very fragmented, and I feel like she was able to do what she wanted to do using silence and creating her own language.
Mm-hmm.
And what is my point? I think that's my point. So
right, yeah.
And she was one of the four people I wrote my master's thesis on, too, was this idea of how to use that marginalization or silence and power, how to not engage in power and to actually stay in one's own vulnerability, which might be a silence, right? Because the thing that happens when we're marginalized or silenced, and I see this so often, is then we want the power. We want to be acknowledged. We want to have money. We want to have the power, or we use the language of power, and then we just become part of the problem.
Right.
So how can we be seen without doing that thing? And that is, it's like resisting, but it's complicated. And so that's the thing I'm very interested in. And I think she was able to do that, but at a cost. And I think Paul Celan also at a cost. So that line isn't, in direct communication, but it's obviously close because this whole project of hers is something I'm thinking of.
And unfortunately, we're running out of time because I think I'm just barely beginning to learn how to talk to you and to ask you the right questions. But the book is, it's an amazing experience to go into these poems. And I even imagine, and I don't know if this is my imagination, if it's my brain making patterns where patterns aren't there. But I even imagine there is a narrative going on in this poem. I mean, in this book, that it's really a book. It's not just an arbitrary collection of poems, but you do take us into this world that is sometimes horrific. It's sometimes close to death, and it's sometimes just an incredible experience. I want to thank you for that. And I know you got the Hodder Fellowship, and if people don't know what that is, I believe 2 years, you just get to live on the Princeton campus, and they give you money, and you write. and I know you've won a lot of prizes, and you're getting a lot of attention for your books, and you're very young, so I'm just really awed and amazed. I'm sure you have a lot to continue to contribute, and thank you for this book. Would you be willing to read a poem before we go?
Sure, and I also thank you so much for inviting me in this wonderful conversation and all the generous things that you just said. That was very nice. Is there maybe a poem that...
Yes, yes. I don't know if it's true, if your brother really lives in Fresno, but that's where I'm from. I'm part of the Fresno Writers group, all the writers that come from Fresno. And I love one of the lines from this poem when he stares at the dead bodies of automobiles in his garage. Oh my God, it's so beautiful. But I love the poem. I was wondering if you would read The Hinge.
Yeah, no, thank you. I'm glad you asked. I really love this poem. It's a secret poem.
A secret poem?
That means. But, that very quickly I'll just say that there's this idea, right, that somehow being a poet or being an academic or whatever that is somehow it's privileged over being an auto mechanic.
Yeah.
And I know my brother's been asked, a million times, like, don't you want to go to college or don't you want to do something else? Or people have at least asked me that. And this poem is partly in response to that there's no difference.
Does he really live in Fresno?
He doesn't. He lives in Porterville.
Okay, well, that was a dumb question.
Porterville doesn't work as well in the palm.
Yeah, no, Fresno sounds better. Okay. You know, it's funny because I just had Ocean Vuong on the show a couple of weeks ago, and in one of his poems, he talks about his, I think, his father living in Fresno, and I was all excited. I go, does he really live in Fresno? And he goes, no, it's just for the poem.
I thought he did live in Fresno, actually. I should have asked him. Okay, I will read the poem, right. The Hinge. My brother is still alive and living in Fresno. All day he stares at the dead bodies of automobiles in his garage. It isn't a prison he would wish himself free of. I visit him dragging my boxes of books and awards behind me. We are walking out of the city into the white flame of the desert. Not unlike the desert fathers walking out into Sinai. My brother carries his briefcase loaded in icons and dollar bills. He is wearing Larry Levis's shining suit and black leather boots. I am wearing a pale gown of sun-bleached flowers. We are talking about the resurrection. We are walking dead into it, leaving the world and its sweet chorus of horrors behind. There is no city but the city within, no door but the door to simple wisdom. We walk, dumb as newborns, into the tremendous and endless blessing.
That was Cynthia Cruz reading the poem The Hinge from her latest book of poems, How the End Begins. Cynthia, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Sorry if I was discombobulated and not sure how to articulate some of the questions, but your book brought me there, and I think it's a good place to be.
Yeah, no. It was hopefully that's actually what the poems do, right?
Yeah. But very nice talking to you.
Yes, thank you. And thank you so much for including me in this project.
Oh, no, it was my pleasure, my honor. All right, well, you have a great New York City afternoon.
Okay, you too. Bye.
Bye-bye. I'd like to thank my guest, Cynthia Cruz, for joining us on Words on a Wire. Remember, the name of the book is How the End Begins. I invite you to enter into this very weird, eerie landscape. It's a fantastic book, and she is a young, brilliant poet. I'm sure we're going to hear a lot from her. This is her fourth book, How the End Begins. I'm Daniel Chacon. See you next week.